The name of our series is Come Together. It turns out to be a very ambitious undertaking, coming together. Not so much coming together in the same space physically, geographically. I mean, given our present situation, that does present some significant challenges. But even so, that kind of coming together is much, much easier than the kind of coming together Jesus calls us to, the kind of coming together that we all deep down long for. That kind of coming together is significantly more challenging because that kind of coming together costs us something. It costs us our pride. Let's review some of the things you've learned in this series. So far in this series, Come Together, you have learned that the greatest obstacle to our coming together is pride, something which you are keenly aware of in others but tend to be blind to in yourself. You've learned that you're not that important. You've learned that your life is really not about you. You've learned that you're not in control of your life. You've learned that you're mortal. You have significant limitations and that you will one day expire. And last week, you learned that, or were reminded that you are mostly ignorant. This series just keeps getting better and better, doesn't it? But as it turns out, all of these truths, if we embrace them, are incredibly freeing. They're liberating. And embracing all of these truths is essential if we're going to come together. As long as we hang on to our pride, our inflated sense of our own importance, our need for control, as long as we cling to a storyline where we are the main character in the story of our life, we have the lead role. As long as we cling to our life and insist it is about us, we will not come together in the way that we were meant to come together. See, we come together when we have nothing to prove, nothing to lose, nothing to hide. That is freedom. We come together when we follow Jesus to the back of the line, to the bottom of the hierarchical structure, and we really begin to consider others as more important than ourselves, as better than ourselves, as our first century father in the faith, Paul, encourages us to do. This is radical stuff, but it is the hope of the world, and it is what the kingdom of heaven is all about. Well, today I want to look at a portion of a letter the Apostle Paul wrote to some of his fellow Christians living in Rome in the first century. And it's helpful to remember that before Paul became a Christian, he was a Pharisee in every sense of the word, including the worst sense of the word. A self-righteous, hyper-religious, judgmental, finger-wagging, hypocritical Pharisee by his own admission. But Jesus got a hold of Paul in a profound way, and Paul became a man filled with great compassion and humility and grace, as is evidenced through the various letters that he wrote. This is the guy that wrote that famous love chapter, you know, that's read at so many weddings even to this day. Yeah, this former Pharisaical judgmental terrorist wrote that mushy, gushy, syrupy, sentimental Bible passage. In fact, let's read part of it. Paul writes, "Love is patient and love is kind, does not envy, does not boast, and is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails." Paul, the Pharisee turned Jesus follower, wrote that. Paul, the guy who before he met Jesus used to have Christians arrested, beaten, and executed because he believed they were heretics who were not following the rules and were threatening to dilute the Jewish faith. And now he's writing stuff like that and being severely persecuted for it. Yeah, his former fellow Pharisees wind up turning on him big time, trying to destroy him and everything he stood for. Well, they failed, obviously. But how did this transformation take place in this guy? Where did this murderous hypocrite get this radical concept of this totally unselfish, self-sacrificing love? Well, from Jesus, obviously. Jesus, who said, "Love one another." But he didn't stop there. He also said, love your neighbor. And of course, his followers had to get clarification. Who's my neighbor, Lord? Well, they didn't like his answer. And Jesus didn't even stop there. Jesus said, love your enemies. And nowadays, you know, we're like, Jesus, who exactly is my enemy? Because you couldn't possibly mean that I'm supposed to love that guy. This ex-Pharisee Paul, he wrote a letter to some fellow Christians living in Rome, and he addresses a problem that had been threatening to create division among them. There were many issues, but here in this section, Paul addresses the issue of whether or not it's okay to eat meat that has been previously sacrificed to an idol. And this is what he writes. Accept the one whose faith is weak without quarreling over disputable matters. So, there are disputable matters within the Christian faith. Apparently, not everything is always black and white. I mean, make no mistake, there are also indisputable matters. I mean, here's just a few. God is real, indisputable for the Christian. I mean, lots of people still consider the existence of God as a disputable matter, and of course, that's to be expected. But a Christian is one who's pretty much settled that issue in his mind and in his heart. There is a God. A Christian considers that indisputable. Another indisputable matter, mankind's rejection of God has caused all kinds of problems in this world. It's hard for anybody to dispute that, but for the Christian especially, indisputable. How about this one? God came to earth physically in the person of Jesus to rescue us. Christians are all in agreement on that. They don't dispute this. It's indisputable. How about this one? Eating a ribeye steak from a cow sacrificed to a Roman deity is a sin. Now that's disputable. I mean, really, come on. How can somebody possibly think that? I mean, let's go. Let's talk about this. Let's argue this out. Let's rumble. Apparently, that was the disputatious atmosphere developing among the Christians in Rome. And that's what Paul was writing to address in this section of the letter. Accept the one whose faith is weak without quarreling over disputable matters. One person's faith allows them to eat anything, but another whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. There you go, vegans. Your faith is weak. It's in the Bible. So there. Actually, no. Most vegans today are not vegans for religious reasons, but for health reasons. And this verse isn't addressing that. Regardless, here's Paul's encouragement. Remember, Paul, the self-righteous, finger-pointing, legalistic Pharisee. This is what he writes. The one who eats everything must not treat with contempt the one who does not. And the one who does not eat everything must not judge the one who does, for God has accepted them. Now today, there's not that much division over whether or not eating meat sacrificed to pagan deities is sinful, at least not that I'm aware of. I haven't seen heated debates about this on social media, so I'm guessing it's not much of an issue these days. But what are some issues these days that are dividing people? Well, there are many. The biggest ones seem to be more political in nature. Let's just see if there's something we can learn from what Paul teaches the Romans in their division and disagreements. So be thinking about something, be thinking about some of today's divisive issues as we go through this, okay? Get that in mind as we go through this. So Paul basically says here, whatever the issue, person A must not treat with contempt person B, right? Must not treat with contempt. Here's how that phrase is translated in other translations of the Bible. Other translations say must not ridicule, must not look down on, must not despise. Some other translations say must not demean. Now, in case you haven't noticed, for a lot of people, it would seem that that's the whole point. That's the primary objective, is to demean and to ridicule and to despise and look down on the other side and to get you to do the same. And we've become very, very good at it, extremely effective. I mean, there are those who actually make a living doing that. Paul says that is not the way of the Jesus follower. That is not the spirit or nature of Jesus who said, love your enemies. Pray for those who hurt you, who mistreat you, who falsely malign you, who are unjust toward you. Love them and pray for them. I mean, come on, you know this. The way this world operates is upside down and backwards from the way the kingdom of heaven operates. Always has, always will be. Don't let this world suck you into its ways. That's why Paul said just a little bit earlier in this letter, just a few lines earlier, a little bit earlier, he says this, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Incidentally, the very next verse is, "Do not think more highly of yourself than you ought." And then he goes on into this metaphor of one body with many parts. Paul says, person A must not treat with contempt person B, and person B must not judge person A, for God has accepted them. Must not judge. Other translations say must not pass judgment, must not criticize, must not condemn. He goes on, who are you to judge someone else's servant? To their own master, servants stand or fall, and they will stand, for the Lord is able to make them stand. And then Paul mentions another disputable matter they were dealing with. One person considers one day more sacred than another. Another considers every day alike. Some say you should worship on Saturday. Some say you should worship on Sunday. Some say you should fast during Lent or give up something for Lent. Others say you should give up Lent, you know. Each one of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. Now, for a lot of people, this is where it starts to sound illogical and maybe impossible to live out. It begins to smack of moral relativism. Because, you know, if something's true, it's true for everybody, right? It's either right or it's wrong. It's either good or bad. But here, Paul says, each one should be convinced in their own mind. This is where it is helpful to remember what we talked about last week, that you are mostly ignorant, and so am I. This is where it's helpful and frankly very liberating to acknowledge that you may not have all the facts. It really is very liberating simply to say sometimes, even out loud, I could be wrong, because there is always that possibility. Mark Twain once said, "What gets us into trouble is not what we don't know. It's what we know for sure that just ain't so." Again, it's just called humility. You can know facts, but if you don't know all the facts, you could draw false conclusions. People do this all the time, and they pay a huge price for it. It seems like many of our sources of information have become very skilled providing facts, but just not all the facts. Regardless of what your media source is, if you have a lot of facts but don't have all the facts, you will likely draw wrong conclusions. I think it's wise just to always consider the possibility that for every fact you read or hear today, there's a yeah, but, right? It's called critical thinking. Your sources would love for nothing more than to make you believe that you're getting from them the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. They work very hard at trying to convince you of that. Most people, though, know better. And I think there is a growing number of people who are figuring that out. Paul goes on, "Whoever regards one day as special does so to the Lord. Whoever eats meat does so to the Lord, for they give thanks to God. And whoever abstains does so to the Lord and gives thanks to God. For none of us lives for ourselves alone, and none of us dies for ourselves alone." So Paul is making some huge assumptions here, and he does so as one who has been with Jesus and caught his spirit of grace. He says, whatever person A is doing, you, as a Jesus follower, assume they are doing it in an effort to be more like Jesus and to honor Jesus. And whatever person B is doing, you, as a Jesus follower, assume they are doing it in an effort to be like Jesus and to honor him. Both sides should be applauded and celebrated and honored, not ridiculed, not held in contempt. You say, yeah, but they don't know they're being sold a bill of goods. You know what? Paul seems to think that's not the priority. The most important thing is not to convince them they're being sold a bill of goods. The important thing is to look at their heart and say, way to go, brother, way to go, sister, because, Paul continues, because if we live, we live for the Lord, and if we die, we die for the Lord. So whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. Are you catching this? Are you noticing? These brothers and sisters are learning and living out some essential truths, that they're not that important, that their lives are not about them, that they are destined to die a physical death one day. Paul says, right on, you guys are getting it. For this reason, Christ died and returned to life so that he might be the Lord of both the dead and the living. You then, why do you judge your brother or sister? Or why do you treat them with contempt? For we will all stand before God's judgment seat. Listen, when you stand before God, he's not going to ask you how many people you were able to convince to wear a mask or to not wear a mask or to vote Republican or to vote Democrat or whatever. He's going to look at how you loved others and valued them and served them and built them up. It is written, as surely as I live, says the Lord, every knee will bow before me, every tongue will acknowledge God. So then, each of us will give an account of ourselves to God. Just reminding you that you're not the lead character in your story. Jesus is. Every knee will one day bow before him, not you. Your life is not about you. Good news for you. Your life is about something and someone much greater than you. Therefore, let us stop passing judgment on one another. Instead, make up your mind not to put a stumbling block or obstacle in the way of a brother or sister. And then, after all that, after he communicates the really important stuff, then he says this, now, I'm convinced, being fully persuaded in the Lord Jesus, that nothing is unclean in itself. It's kind of like, you know, an aside. Paul says, okay, listen, just for the record, in my opinion, the way I see it, this whole meat offered to idols thing, it's a non-issue. There's nothing wrong with it, you know. That's what he says. And I can hear some of those Christians in Rome going, then why don't you tell them that? Why don't you straighten them out? I mean, come on. Don't you know that you're one day, your words are going to be part of the Bible, divinely inspired, infallible? You should go on record, set the record straight, straighten these people out. And he's like, you know what? They really don't need to be straightened out. They are loving Jesus with their life. Person A is loving Jesus with their life. Person B is loving Jesus with their life. And some of you are like, no, they're not. They're being selfish and they're caving into fear and they're buying into conspiracy theories and they don't care if people die and lose their jobs and can't support their families. Paul says, stop judging. Stop being a hypocrite. Stop tearing down your brother and sister, both of you. Just stop it. You know what? Listen, I'm not going to try to pretend this is a simple thing. It's not. It raises a lot of questions. It really does. But here's the deal. I think it's best to think of this not so much as a problem to solve, but rather as a tension to manage. And what Paul brilliantly and lovingly does here is give us the tools, the approach, the mentality to manage this tension. And the key here is simply love. Love and humility. He says, you know what? Be fully convinced in your own mind on these issues while extending grace and freedom and respect and honor to those who are convinced otherwise. Can you imagine what the world would be like? You know, I mean, my tendency is to want to straighten them out, to teach them what they need to know. You know, I want to give them insight and information because I believe if they had the right information and saw things correctly, the way I see them, they would be happier and freer. And plus, they'd see that I was right and that I'm smarter than them. No, not necessarily. I mean, it's actually possible It's possible my intention, my honest motive, really is just to give them better understanding that may result in their living more free from guilt and legalism and ultimately making the world a better place. But you know what? That might be a good thing. That might be a good thing. But what Paul is teaching us here is that it may not be the best thing. See, Paul includes a very similar narrative in a letter he wrote to the Christians living in Corinth. And I quoted the first part of that verse last week. You know, it's the verse where in the verse it says, you know, Paul goes, "We know we all have knowledge." Listen, here's the problem. They're convinced they know something you don't know. You're convinced you know something they don't know. They're convinced they know something you don't know. Maybe they're convinced you're the ignorant one. In fact, let me just assure you, they are convinced of that. And that's why it's so important for all of us just to remember that we're all mostly ignorant. Richard Rohr, he once said this, "A master teacher acknowledges what you know, but never lets you forget what you do not know. He never lets you forget that you don't know everything, keeps you humble, and you know what else? Makes you a much more pleasant person to be around." And that's why Jesus reminded us that there are things that children know that even the intelligent and highly educated don't know, from a verse I quoted last week. Paul says, you know what? Maybe they're just not ready to have that discussion yet. Maybe they are so rooted in their convictions that you're just not going to be all that helpful. And maybe, just maybe, you're the one that's got it wrong. Skipping down a few verses, Paul says this, and I'll end with this. "We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not just please ourselves." In other words, the ones who are strong in faith, they're always going to be the ones who yield to and accommodate their weaker brothers and sisters. You know what this means? It means that there is a race, that there's a competition to see who will accommodate the other, to see who will give the most room to the other person's perspectives, viewpoints, convictions, ideas. The one who yields the most ground, Paul says, that's the strong one. That's the one whose faith is strong. So here we go. Here we go. I'll race you to the back of the line. I'll race you to the bottom of the pile. Dear Jesus, help us to get this. This is so important. We let so many things divide us. Some of them are seemingly important things, but they're not the most important thing. And the most important thing in your book is that we love you and love one another, period. And Lord, help us to sort out. Help us to manage this tension, but help us to do so in a way where we love one another as you have loved us. Teach us what that really means. You loved us in all of our weakness and in all of our brokenness and all of our ignorance. Help us to love one another that way, in Jesus' name.